do it. Cool. Welcome to another edition of the X Collective. Today we're going to talk about public affairs and how that can be turned into a competitive advantage for revenue leaders. Public affairs, regulatory strategy and a commercial mindset are not often used in the same sentence. And I would argue it's probably not closest to the heart of your ordinary revenue leader. But those who are affected by it do well by monitoring it closely and utilizing it actually to the advantage and using it as a business competitive advantage. Today, I have the pleasure to speak about this with Spencer Hayes and looking forward to draft upon your vast experience working amongst monumental companies like Uber to talk about how early stage companies can actually use their regulatory strategy to their advantage in expanding internationally. Spencer, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to it.
Me too. Super excited about it and really enjoyed our conversation that we had just before to prep the call. We're going to talk all about public affairs and regulatory strategy. And I'm super excited to see how this intersects with revenue management and expansion. But before we do all of this, can you please provide the audience with a quick, let's say, summary of your background and what drives you?
Sure thing. So I spent years on the regulatory team at Uber dealing with regulatory strategy, policy strategy, and how it connects to market expansion, international expansion, and business growth as a whole. And about 3 years ago, my now co-founder and a colleague of mine at the time from Uber looked around the marketplace and realized there really was a dearth of focus and resources around how early and mid-stage companies think about regulatory strategy and sort of taking a lot of those lessons that we learned at Uber in particular and applying them to much earlier stage companies sort of in that journey of, hey, if I'm a young company, I'm going to have to deal with government, broadly speaking, in one sense or another as I scale. How do I do that? How does this world work? How do I address these types of issues without incinerating a bunch of money, without spinning my wheels? What are the types of obstacles that I need to be aware of? And so we decided to start a firm really focused around that, help companies avoid, I think, frankly, some of the mistakes we've seen, the previous generation of companies like your Ubers and Airbnbs make, and also learn from a lot of their successes and lessons as well.
Exciting, exciting. And can you tell me a little bit about your company, Runway Strategies? Where do you work? What is your scope? And what type of companies do you tend to work with?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a global advisory firm. We have offices in DC, here in Amsterdam, Mexico City. We work with clients all over the world. Our focus really is early to mid-stage tech companies, and we work with them on regulatory policy and communication strategy, and really with companies, again, for which their growth trajectory, their scale, is going to involve some type of interaction with governments, whether that's they're going to need to go out and change regulations, whether that's they're in emerging and novel spaces and they're going to have to deal with government stakeholders to navigate the gray as they grow, whether that's they're in a politically sensitive space and they need to be proactive about the story that they're telling and building trust, building confidence, building political capital. We work with those companies on understanding how the space works, what that company's particular needs, priorities, risks are, how they're going to address that, and then help them put that strategy actually into practice and drive results in this space, again, with, I think, the mindset of achieving the objectives necessary for growth, but spending a lot less money and a lot less time in the process.
Yeah, I think that's particularly exciting to learn because, if I think about public affairs and regulatory strategy, it sounds like overwhelming and sort of a necessary evil that I need to manage as a founder because I have so many things to juggle between and manage on a day-to-day. And this is such a, vast and complex thing. How do I approach this in a super pragmatic way that it adds value to my business without overcomplicating things? That's I think, where we would like to learn how you apply this and how founders and revenue leaders can actually apply this straight away into their business.
Yeah.
Maybe before we go into depth, please elaborate a little bit on the concept of public affairs and regulatory strategy what the do's and don'ts are for companies to in the early stage growth phase.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I would say as a whole, public affairs, regulatory strategy, and also public policy, government relations, government affairs. They're all terms that have somewhat specific meanings, but oftentimes are used interchangeably. And what we really mean by that as sort of a broad term is what is a company's strategy going to be for how government is going to impact its growth? And again, as we were just talking about, what that means can take lots of different forms for different companies. But for your business, understanding what are your exposure points and what are you going to do about them, whether that's being proactive, whether it's being reactive, whatever it might be, is having a clear sense of that. And that's really what we're talking about. And I think another thing to be clear about as revenue leaders, and particularly for companies that are just starting to think about this space, is not every company really has to invest heavily in this space. There's plenty of businesses that are, you know, up the middle. They don't have a lot of regulatory issues. They don't have a lot of government issues. So it's not something that every revenue leader, every early stage business really needs to think a lot about. But where we do see a lot of issues is, I think as you were just alluding to, because it's a space that feels nebulous, amorphous, it feels like a necessary evil, it's hard a lot of times to see sort of the hard metrics and ROI coming out of it. A lot of companies tend to just not think about it at all. And what we oftentimes recommend is, look, just spend some time early on thinking about this. Make sure you understand, do we have exposure points? What are they going to look like? And if you do, what's the right time to address them? It may be now, it may be later, but the important thing is to have a clear roadmap of, is this a space I need to think about? And what does that look like long-term? So you can factor into your go-to-market strategy, your growth strategy, and overall your resource planning as well.
Yeah, and it's complex because, especially in Europe, but also if you have a horizon outside of Europe, the regulatory framework is slightly different in every market, right? So it can also be quite a daunting task to get this overview in a convenient way for the markets that you actually want to enter. But you mentioned something interesting. It's not for every. It's not relevant for every company in every phase of growth, right? So what type of companies would you consider this to be relevant for and which companies less so? So when is it important to have proactive, let's say, strategy with regards to public affairs and regulatory, let's say, environments?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question. So I think there's two aspects to this, right? One, I want to make sure to stress that I think every company should make sure they sit down and go through this process to see if they have exposure here. Sort of don't assume up front that your business is immune from this. You may well not have a lot of needs in the space, but still go through the exercise to make sure. But so then what are the companies that go through that exercise and are going to discover they probably have a lot of needs in the space? Certainly companies in emerging and evolving areas where there's a lot of white space, there is arguably not a lot of regulation directly on point. I think right now we're seeing generative AI. It's a huge example of that, a space that has grown up with to date, not a lot of direct regulation. I think we see a lot of signs that that's about to change and change very quickly. Crypto is an interesting space. I think depending on which regulator you ask, you might get a response that there's plenty of regulation in this space. I think a lot of companies would say otherwise. But crypto is perhaps a good example of a broader concept of, you know, companies that are operating in a regulatory gray area for one reason or another. And I think if you look backwards, you know, clear sort of past examples of this are your Airbnbs, your Ubers, companies that were in spaces that had existed for a long time. They have a novel product, a novel approach, an argument that what they are doing is different and unregulated or should be regulated differently. Those are the types of companies that have very acute needs in this space. I would also lump in companies that tend to have more political sensitivity or potentially sort of a unusual product that may sort of fit within an existing reg framework, but what they are, how they tell their story is going to be a critical aspect of not just their long-term regulatory success, but product growth as well. And I think cultivated meat's a great example of that, where a lot of these companies are basically saying, look, we can get approved through the food safety approval processes that have existed, but how we do that, what kind of approvals we get, what our products are labeled as, all of those things, obviously is very important to the future of the business, the pace at which they can grow. And those are the types of companies that, again, need to be thinking very concretely about what are the issues here and how are we going to address them.
Okay, clear. So is it fair to distinguish between, let's say, three categories, generally speaking? So there's obviously companies that, you know, operate in a clear space without very big exposure to regulatory environments or regulatory frameworks, or that fit in nicely and don't need, you know, this to be a competence within their internal organization. Then there is companies that obviously need to comply to regulatory frameworks, like, for example, if you want to apply for a banking license. But this is, has almost become institutionalized and transactional. And then there is, in the middle, these companies that act in a gray space. And this is really where the you know, the magic happens, right?
I think that's right. And I think there's, I would also emphasize, I think there's some companies that are going to find themselves in a position of, look, we can grow in the existing framework, but our path to scale is going to require us to craft new regulatory frameworks. And that sort of can sit between those first and sort of middle categories. But a lot of companies find themselves there of, you know, look, we can build a medium-sized business if things stay as they are, but we can build a rocket ship if we're able to go out and actually change
turn it
the laws
into
around
your
us.
And turn it into your advantage, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. Tell me a little bit about how regulatory strategy can impact your go-to-market approach and how it can create opportunity. Maybe you have some practical examples of things, you know, in a situation where it is really turned into a big edge and where it became a big fiasco.
Yeah. So, look, I think one of the most acute ways it's going to impact go-to-market strategy is really your ability to launch and scale, right? So I think if you're a company, you're looking at entering a new market, and we can talk more about sort of how you go about doing market prioritization and evaluating regulatory environments across markets. But say you pick a country and you want to launch there. As we were just talking about, right, you may find yourself in a situation where you can build but you can't scale. That regulatory framework is going to impact how quickly you can grow, what kinds of products you can launch, maybe how you market those products, sell those products. And a lot of businesses find themselves in a position of how much risk to take, right? Is this something where if you're operating in a gray, you know, it's unclear perhaps if what you're doing is, for lack of a better term, legal or not. How much do you want to get close to the line? A lot goes into sort of those kinds of evaluations, and we can talk more about that as well. But the bottom line is regulatory strategy is relevant to whether you can actually build this market and also whether you can continue to operate this market. And so I think in terms of examples people are, I think, undoubtedly familiar with, we can take Uber to start, right? Uber's a business that comes in, launches in markets where, you know, generally speaking, I think a lot of regulators would have taken the position that you know, the current laws either constricted or forbid what Uber's model was attempting to be. Plenty of others took a different view of that. But certainly, I think anybody familiar with sort of Uber's journey could see that in some markets, Uber was able to scale very quickly, continue operating. Other markets, Uber was either shut down or close to it or heavily constrained. Those regulatory environments had very direct, very tangible, concrete, obvious impacts on Uber's business.
Of course.
And I think a much more recent example is if you look at the quick commerce space, particularly here in the Netherlands and a lot of other European markets, it's an industry that grew incredibly quickly. The pace of growth is obviously just astounding and then has, you know, fairly rapidly come face to face with real regulatory and public policy hindrances. And I sort of emphasize both the regulatory and policy insofar as there are certainly regulatory and legal barriers that are constraining or really reversing a lot of the growth that quick commerce companies have seen. But also underneath that is a sort of political or policy mindset that in many markets they're perceived unfavorably. And there's many ways to potentially kind of thread that needle and try to address those types of issues, but you certainly see a very direct impact from the regulatory and policy environment on that GTM and growth strategy.
It's quite hard to predict these outcomes, especially now with this example of the quick commerce space, because I think Getir was very successful in Turkey, but obviously the socioeconomic structures and the way you know, cities are designed and the way the whole, let's say, society operates is completely different than here in Western Europe, where indeed these quick commerce players were scrutinized and now constrained in the way they could expand and have these outlets in the cities, right?
Yeah.
So it's super hard also to predict this. Well, it's actually a big jeopardy to your whole business case that you make, that you build a business on, and that you you know, acquire investors for that fund this exercise, right? So it's a bit of a, feels a bit like pioneering with a bit of a crystal ball sometimes.
I think that's right, because I think there's, even if you can, and this is obviously particularly acute with regards to international expansion and cross-regional expansion, but if you look at another market and you feel like you have a good sense of what the law says, right, or what that black letter text is, how you're going to be perceived, how that's going to be interpreted, how your approach is going to be received in that market, obviously can be very different. And it's sort of an academic point, but one that is genuinely very difficult, of that recognition of things work differently in different places, which is really easy to sort of say, but how to internalize that as a business and incorporate that proactively into your launch strategy and your regulatory strategy, I think as we see mirrored over and over again from lots of companies, the issues they face, is difficult to do.
Yeah, and I think what's also interesting to consider is that I think if you think about public affairs and regulatory environments, your association is that regulators are slow to adapt and move. However, I think in the past 10 years, we have seen regulators move very quickly with new business models coming up, with existential threats to society like COVID. The way the regulators respond to crypto, maybe slow, but relatively speaking, this is a very adaptive and fast moving regulatory environment, right?
Yep.
So, that's also, I think, a good realization that the whole regulatory environment and regulatory frameworks are actually in flux at the moment, more even faster than they've ever been before.
I think that's an excellent point. I think if we look back to sort of the last 10 years of regulation, I think you're right. Regulators have historically been very slow to adjust, and I think they've internalized that. And so I think while these issues have always been acute for companies in regulated spaces, it's really worth emphasizing the point you just made of the fact that regulators are moving more quickly than they ever have. And so for companies that do have exposure, particularly on large hot ticket topics of generative AI, crypto, et cetera, the pace of change here is going to be very, very quick. And for companies that are going to be impacted by those regulations, they may find the environment that they're operating in much different, much more quickly than they expect.
Yeah,
and so it really behooves them to get out in front of this as much as possible.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. It's such a big aspect of building your business case, essentially, if obviously this is relevant to you, if you operate in this space, that is actually influenced by this.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the topic of expansion. If I'm a revenue leader and I'm planning for market expansion, how do I assess favorability of, let's say, local regulatory frameworks, so markets that I want to enter?
Yep.
How do I assess what the favorability is? How do I rank this effectively and integrate this into my expansion plan?
Yeah, so there's a few steps to this. The sort of, I think, simplest one, but deceptively simple at times, is, well, what does the law say in all these markets? And to some extent, it seems like an easy question. Well, I know the 10 markets I want to evaluate. I'll just go off and ask lawyers in those 10 markets what the laws are for my business and then pick based on that.
Yeah.
The issue you bump into very, very quickly is if you go off and ask 10 different lawyers the same question, you're going to get 10 very different answers. And so you're going to spend a lot of money and you're going to get a result back that, when you're trying to compare apples to apples, is not useful for that. And it's also generally going to be written in different types of legalese and therefore not terribly useful for your business leaders. And so the real trick is how you go out and get a sort of common framework analysis. How can you go out and get lawyers to give you answers in a way that really gives you a meaningful sense of what the environment actually looks like, and you can easily compare? And you can also easily compare without being a lawyer and spending time reviewing endless memos. And that's something we work on a lot with clients ourselves is, you know, how do you kind of put those just basic frameworks in place so that you spend less money and spend less time? So one thing to just kind of emphasize is it makes sense for companies to think about that upfront. Otherwise, you can very quickly get a bunch of stuff back and be like, why did we spend this? But let's go sort of past that, right? You've got the answers, you understand sort of what the law says. I think a lot of times for companies in the spaces that we're talking about, the answer is going to be maybe a lot of times. They're going to get different degrees of, well, we're kind of in a gray area for one reason or another. And so then the question becomes, well, what do I do with this?
Yeah.
Right? Like, do we launch? Do we not launch? How do we compare these markets? And this actually ties into something that you and I were just talking about, which is having some perspective, that market-specific, cultural-specific context of, if I run into the gray in this market, how's that going to be perceived? What does risk look like here? Is really important to factor into that strategy. And when I talk about risk, I think a lot of times companies think about risk in this space as legal risk. It's a regulatory analysis. So what's the legal risk that comes out of that? And legal risk certainly is material, right? Like, can I get shut down? Can I go to jail? How much do I get fined? Obviously, all very important questions. But that's not the full spectrum of risk. I think a lot of times what companies fail to incorporate into that analysis is, what about political risk? Mm-hmm. What about brand risk, the optics of it? And there's short-term and long-term components, right? Like, you may be able to go into a market and launch and grow, but if you develop a lot of bad will with the public, with regulators, mm-hmm. whatever it might be, when push comes to shove down the road and you need to try to change that regulatory framework, or you need to push back against regulatory scrutiny, your ability to do so may be severely hampered by that bad will that you've created.
Yeah.
That's not to say for some companies that the right answer still isn't to go do that, but it's to make sure that as you're building out that go-to-market strategy, you're incorporating the regulatory piece, you're incorporating sort of this full spectrum of risk in this space and making purposeful calculations and taking intentional risks as opposed to just doing it and then ending up later in a position of, oh no.
Yeah, no, and so turning it more into a sort of calculated a risk rather than to go in like through stretch legs and see what happens, right?
I think that's right. I mean, certainly it's much more exciting to take the, oh, we'll do it and see what happens, but it doesn't usually turn out the best.
But from everything that you analyze, I think the obvious one is also economic risk. And as a revenue leader, obviously the way you are perceived in local markets and all the risks that you mentioned are relevant because it may influence the success of commercial success of my organization in a respective market. But if I enter a market that I need to retract from, that is obviously from an economic point of view also a hefty loss, right? So it touches actually upon every aspect. Let's go back to the comparison, because you mentioned the frameworks and you need to be smart about what areas of the business potentially have exposure within these markets. But mm-hmm. how do you do this practically? Like, do you create a table where you have like a comparison of all these different components that are relevant? And how do you engage the right lawyers, or how can you do this yourself?
Yeah, it's a great question. So. One is, oftentimes a table, even something as basic as that, can really be helpful. It requires you to, really work cross-functionally internally before you go off and get these analyses of what are the very specific questions we need to know? What are the sub-questions to that? These can get, to be pretty long pretty quickly, but then so is an endless legalese memo you get from lawyers anyways, right? So it's a matter of basically, instead of the memo, get a long table that really answers what you need, lets you compare apples to apples.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of this is you want to have, if you don't, I think, if you're not at the stage as a company where you have the luxury of internal counsel or someone with specialization in this space, it's at least having somebody internally who owns this, who is going to really be thinking strategically about what you're trying to accomplish with this exercise, and is going to collaborate with the lawyers, sort of checking in sort of as they're doing this. Are you getting answers in the formats that you need? Are you getting enough detail? Are you getting too much detail? It's really the kind of thing where guiding this and having somebody, one person whose job is to know sort of across the spectrum what's coming in and what's being done is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of actually finding those resources, oftentimes, if you have a lawyer that you trust, sometimes you can go to them and say, look, have you done cross-border work previously, or the firms that you work with? If not, there are firms that specialize in this type of work, or working with an external resource in the space more broadly that may already have those resources can be helpful. What you really want to try to do, and this is true for so many things with lawyers, get recommendations. Find people that have done this before. Just finding the best law firm in each country and then asking them to sort of be part of your project is a really great way to spend a bunch of cash and not get a lot for it.
Okay, that makes sense. And how do I approach this? Because I do this obviously when I make my market selection assessment. And then determine, am I willing to take this calculated risk, yes or no, within this market, considering the investments that I need to make versus the opportunity that is there, right, with all the factors that you mentioned. Do I do this upfront, or should I also do this continuously? Because we just agreed that, the regulatory environment is more volatile than ever. So I guess it also changes, right, as we progress. And how do you monitor this market closely?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one thing that we oftentimes see companies under-prioritize is that monitoring sort of real-time awareness. If you're operating in a market, you need to understand is that regulatory environment potentially going to change? And I think a lot of times we think about this in terms of, you know, big ticket, like legalize the industry, make the industry legal, or like, you know, crypto and the SEC right now or something like that. But it can be really small changes around the edges, you know, little something getting stuck into a bill somewhere that isn't going to like pose an existential risk to your business, but could constrain a product line or a vertical, whatever it might be. So it's important for companies to take some type of step, have some type of process in place to have awareness of what is moving in markets that are relevant to them, putting aside the prospective launch, as you were saying, but just markets where you're currently operating, so that if there is something coming down the pipe at the legislative or regulatory level that is relevant to the business, you're aware of it. Maybe you're at the stage as a company where you can allocate the resources to go off and try to change that, maybe lobby on that bill or that draft regulation. But even if not, it at least gives you a longer runway internally to plan for those types of changes and do the contingency planning you need to from a product and growth planning perspective.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess, you know, it does not only make sense to monitor this for the markets that you're active, but also for markets that you want to actually enter, because if regulations change, they may also create a white space and to out-compete, let's say, competitors to market.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Do you have experiences or have you worked with companies that have actually utilized this as a tactic for market entry let's say being first to market?
So I think we see it across not just first to market, but just generally. Like the reality is most companies are not thinking strategically and proactively about this space. There is, I think, going back to what we were saying at the outset of this conversation, right? A lot of times this mindset of, I don't want to worry about it, it's too amorphous, whatever. And so for companies that are proactive about this space, it becomes pretty quickly a pretty significant competitive advantage. Whether that's going to a market first, or whether that's just being sort of the first person in your industry to kind of decide to raise your head up and really engage on these types of issues. Because it allows you to not only, as we were just talking about, potentially head off, you know, negative changes that may impact you, it also allows you to potentially go out and drive positive changes to the regulatory environment that may suit your business model, but perhaps not suit your competitors. It allows you to build political capital so that when something does happen, you already have the trust and the networks needed to engage on those types of issues. It's a space where, you know, again, the ROI here is long tail, but it's very, very real. And it's something that takes investment to build capabilities. But if you go out as a company and you do build that, you're going to have a lot more capabilities relevant to your competitors. And I think the last point to emphasize is, you know, I think oftentimes you see this view from companies of, well, you know, we're part of a broader industry. Other players in the industry are leading on these issues. So, you know, we don't need to invest in it. And certainly sometimes that is true. But the reality is everybody's story, priorities, objectives are different. And if you're not out there telling your story, your competitors or your antagonists are going to be the ones telling that story. And it's really something companies need to think very concretely about, whether they're comfortable with that or whether there really is something specific to them that they need to be out there advocating for or explaining to relevant stakeholders.
And in what stage of company building, you know, does it become relevant to do so? Because obviously, you know, it can be on the first of your, on the top of your priority list, but if you have an organization to manage and you have so many uncertainties still in your business model, does it still make sense to you know, invest in lobbying and proactively influencing the regulatory framework? Or would you rather have your competitors go out and do all the legwork and be able to benefit from it, right? So what is in what stage do you start investing in it, and when are you proactive versus reactive?
It's a great question. It's something that, you know, unfortunately there's not a hard and fast rule to, but I'll try to do better than it depends. look, I think the reality is for a lot of businesses in this space, if you're, you know, a seed stage company, this is probably just not something you're going to be investing in. I think Series A and B is where, for some companies, we start to see enough product market fit, enough revenue, enough size, enough certainty around, at least broadly speaking, longer term objectives, needs, priorities for the business, that those are concrete enough that if they're a business in a space where there's a lot of developing regulation or regulatory friction, it does make sense a lot of times to go off and start doing something in this space. And to be clear, there's a difference between, you know, hey, let's understand sort of what's happening, let's potentially engage in a couple of markets, versus let's go off and hire a gigantic in-house policy team and lobby around the world, right? Exactly. Like it's a stage thing. So I think best I can answer is, I think A to B is usually where companies should really start thinking, not just concretely about it, but potentially proactively. But I think for a lot of companies, and going back to what we were saying at the outset of the call around the importance of going through the exercise, right, is even if you're a seed stage company or a series A company, you're too early to resource this. Going through the exercise of at least really mapping out, okay, as we grow, what do we think our priorities are going to be? What do we think our regulatory risks and exposure points are going to be? How are we going to likely go about solving those? How much is that going to cost? How long is that going to take? At least having some framework that, like, look, is not going to be 100% accurate when push comes to shove. But having gone through that exercise, we found can be helpful for companies on a number of fronts. One, you now can factor that into your growth planning. You can factor it into your resource planning. You also now can go to investors, and unlike basically all of your competitors, you're going to be able to say to investors, look, we're thinking about this space, which shows that you're being thoughtful, you're being proactive, you're being sensible. And we have hard numbers on what we think this means for our growth projections. Look, you're certainly going to have some investors probably come back and be like, we just want the fairy tales and no issues and get out of here kind of thing. But I think for the kind of investors you want, a lot of times, we've seen a lot of companies find that investors appreciate that thoughtfulness. It also saves you from the situation as a company of promising investors the moon when it comes to growth numbers, what have you, and then 6 months, 12 months, 18 months later, suddenly discover, yeah, you can't. And that puts you in a really tough position. Yeah. So even if you're not going to do anything about it, at least go through that exercise and map that out now.
Yeah, so it also acts as an enabler to align stakeholders and actually get consent on this rather than just seeing what happens.
I think that's right.
How do you internalize these capabilities within your organization, and how do you make legal and revenue departments work together?
Yeah,
they're not a match made in heaven necessarily. Right?
I think that's right. Well, look, I think building a commercially focused legal team is a priority for any number of reasons, let alone on this side. So I think first is internalizing generally. Right, like most companies, particularly early on, you're not going to have the resources, nor would it necessarily make sense to bring on somebody full time to do this kind of work. So I think either you're looking at get an external resource in place that can be sort of a fractional head of policy for you and help you understand, you know, what the obstacles are, you know, sort of how the space works, et cetera. Or at the very least, charge somebody internally with, hey, you may not be a policy or legal guy, but we need you to figure out how this world works and be our lead for the time.
Be diligent about it, even though you don't necessarily have somebody with the deep legal expertise.
Exactly. Yeah. Just somebody that can, you want that person to be somebody that can work cross-functionally, both in terms of the substance and just personalities. And you want that person to be pretty dynamic, comfortable learning new areas, but somebody can go off, figure this out and sort of be like, I own this now and I'm going to at least put a strategy in place, which is much better than no strategy. In terms of then when you do have some more in-house resources, so getting legal and revenue to work together, for example, or when you have a legal and a public policy team, it's important to have clear ownership in the space. Who is making the decisions here? And structure your team so that they are incentivized to collaborate. I think an issue we've seen lots of times with companies, particularly as they start to scale these internal teams, and so different internal functions have an interest in regulatory or policy outcomes, is, you know, you may have a lawyer who's covering six markets, right? And their job is to mitigate risk to the business. You might have a policy person in each of those markets because of, you know, language differences, cultural differences. And the policy person, oftentimes, their job is going to be, well, get something done in your market. That's what we're paying you for. And so the policy person will get like a draft bill, and they'll bring it back and they'll be like, well, look, we got this draft bill. And if we say yes to this, like we can go off and we can be done. And the lawyer will be like, well, this is bad in the other five markets that I cover. So we shouldn't take this deal. And the lawyer's like, if we take the deal, obviously I'm simplifying here, but if we take the deal, I'm going to get fired because I'm not protecting the other markets. Policy guy's like, if we don't take the deal, I get fired because we're not going to get this deal done. And neither of those people is wrong, right? It's a failure of internal structure. It's a failure of incentives. Yeah. And so as companies really start to build these functions and these resources internally, it's really important to focus on ownership, common approach, incentives, so that everybody has a incentive, not just in terms of best corporate outcomes, but their own personal futures at the business, how they're compensated, incentivized, professional advancement, to work together on these issues instead of at odds, which is too often the case.
Yeah. Interesting. So actually what you're saying is look at the way and these different teams are incentivized and how you are organized so that you can actually build this into sort of a multidisciplinary team
yeah.
to approach this, right?
Exactly.
Cool. Maybe as a final word, like what would be something what you would recommend founders and revenue leaders to implement or start doing tomorrow to go about this more effectively?
I mean, as we've touched on, I think, a number of times throughout this call today, think about the space. Think about it now and think about it proactively and strategically. Mm-hmm. Again, that does not mean you need to go off and spend a bunch of money. Doesn't mean you necessarily need to do anything coming out of that, but go through that exercise. There's an old saying in this space, when you need a friend in government, it's too late to find one. And that's obviously glib and a bit reductionist, but the sentiment of it is true, which is, again, the payoff in this space and your ability to, as a company, drive change, to protect your business, to build political capital, all these things, those are long-term investments. Mm. You can't wait until the crisis is here and then flip a switch and do something about it. So if you're not thinking longer term and thinking proactively about this space, your ability to really do anything about it is going to be severely limited.
Cool. Spencer, thank you very much. I think it was really exciting to talk about this, and I think there is a lot of opportunity in legal public affairs to work together more closely with revenue teams. Like you mentioned, for legal teams to adopt a commercial mindset also. There's a lot to do. Thank you very much for the inspiring talk, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you. It's been great.
Cheers.